made of pressed sawdust, tar paper, 1 inch of wood sheathing, more tar paper, and then aluminum siding, which was hollow. The space in the siding was filled with a miracle insulating material developed for use on rockets to the moon. Dwayne turned on the floodlights around his house and he played basketball in the blacktop apron outside his 5-car garage. Dwayne's dog Sparky hid in the basement when Dwayne shot up the bathroom, but he came out now. Sparky watched Dwayne play basketball. "You and me, Sparky," said Dwayne, and so on. He sure loved that dog. Nobody saw him playing basketball. He was screened from his neighbors by trees and shrubs and a high cedar fence. He put the basketball away and he climbed into a black Plymouth Fury he had taken in trade the day before. The Plymouth was a Chrysler product, and Dwayne himself sold General Motors products. He had decided to drive the Plymouth for a day or two in order to keep abreast of the competition. As he backed out of his driveway, he thought it important to explain to his neighbors why he was in a Plymouth Fury, so he yelled out the window, "Keeping abreast of the competition!" He blew his horn. Dwayne zoomed down Old Country Road and onto the interstate, which he had all to himself. He swerved into exit 10 at a high rate of speed, slammed into a guardrail, spun around and around. He came out onto Union Avenue going backwards, jumped a curb, and came to stop in a vacant lot. Dwayne owned the lot. Nobody saw or heard anything. Nobody lived in the area. A policeman was supposed to cruise by about once every hour or so, but he was cooping in an alley behind a Western Electric warehouse about 2 miles away. Cooping was police slang for sleeping on the job. Dwayne stayed in his vacant lot for a while. He played the radio. All the Midland City stations were asleep for the night, but Dwayne picked up a country music station in West Virginia, which offered him 10 different kinds of flowering shrubs and 5 fruit trees for $6, COD. "Sounds good to me," said Dwayne. He meant it. Almost all the messages which were sent and received in his country, even the telepathic ones, had to do with buying or selling some damn thing. They were like lullabies to Dwayne. 5. While Dwayne Hoover listened to West Virginia, Kilgore Trout tried to fall asleep in a movie theater in New York City. It was much cheaper than a night in a hotel. Trout had never done it before, but he knew sleeping in movie houses was the sort of thing really dirty old men did. He wished to arrive in Midland City as the dirtiest of all old men. He was supposed to take part in a symposium out there entitled "The Future of the American Novel in the Age of McLuhan." He wished to say at that symposium, "I don't know who McLuhan is, but I know what it's like to spend the night with a lot of other dirty old men in a movie theater in New York City. Could we talk about that?" He wished to say, too, "Does this McLuhan, whoever he is, have anything to say about the relationship between wide-open beavers and the sales of books?" Trout had come down from the Cohos late that afternoon. He had since visited many pornography shops and a shirt store. He had bought 2 of his own books, Plague on Wheels and Now It Can Be Told, a magazine containing a short story of his, and a tuxedo shirt. The name of the magazine was Black Garter Belt. The tuxedo shirt had a cascade of ruffles down its bosom. On the shirt salesman's advice, Trout had also bought a packaged ensemble consisting of a cummerbund, a boutonniere, and a bow tie. They were all the color of tangerines. Those goodies were all in his lap, along with a crackling brown paper parcel containing his tuxedo, 6 new pairs of jockey shorts, 6 new pairs of socks, his razor, and a new toothbrush. Trout hadn't owned a toothbrush for years. The jackets of Plague on Wheels and Now It Can Be Told both promised plenty of wide-open beavers inside. The picture on the cover of Now It Can Be Told, which was the book which would turn Dwayne Hoover into a homicidal maniac, showed a college professor being undressed by a group of naked sorority girls. A library tower could be seen through a window in the sorority house. It was daytime outside, and there was a clock in the tower. The professor was stripped down to his candy-striped underwear shorts and his socks and garters and his mortarboard, which was a hat. There was absolutely nothing about a professor or a sorority or a university anywhere in the body of the book. The book was in the form of a long letter from the creator of the universe to the only creature in the universe who had free will. As for the story in Black Garter Belt magazine, Trout had no idea that it had been accepted for publication. It had been accepted years ago, apparently, for the date on the magazine was April 1962. Trout found it by chance in a bin of tame old magazines near the front of the store. They were underpants magazines. When he bought the magazine, the cashier supposed Trout was drunk or feeble-minded. All he was getting, the cashier thought, was pictures of women in their underpants. Their legs were apart, all right, but they had on underpants, so they were certainly no competition for the wide-open beavers on sale in the back of the store. "I hope you enjoy it," said the cashier to Trout. He meant that he hoped Trout would find some pictures he could masturbate to, since that was the only point of all the books and magazines. "It's for an arts festival," said Trout. As for the story itself, it was entitled The Dancing Fool. Like so many Trout stories, it was about a tragic failure to communicate. Here was the plot. A flying saucer creature named Zog arrived on Earth to explain how wars could be prevented and how cancer could be cured. He brought the information from Margo, a planet where the natives conversed by means of farts and tap dancing. Zog landed at night in Connecticut. He had no sooner touched down than he saw a house on fire. He rushed into the house, farting and tap dancing, warning the people about the terrible danger they were in. The head of the house brained Zog with a golf club. The movie theater where Trout sat with all his parcels in his lap showed nothing but dirty movies. The music was soothing. Phantasms of a young man and a young woman sucked harmlessly on one another's soft apertures on the silver screen. And Trout made up a new novel while he sat there. It was about an Earthling astronaut who arrived on a planet where all the animal and plant life had been killed by pollution, except for humanoids. The humanoids ate food made from petroleum and coal. They gave a feast for the astronaut, whose name was Don. The food was terrible. The big topic of conversation was censorship. The cities were blighted with motion picture theaters which showed nothing but dirty movies. The humanoids wished they could put them out of business somehow, but without interfering with free speech. They asked Don if dirty movies were a problem on Earth, too, and Don said, yes. They asked him if the movies were really dirty, and Don replied, as dirty as movies could get. This was a challenge to the humanoids, who were sure their dirty movies could beat anything on Earth. So everybody piled into air-cushioned vehicles, and they floated to a dirty movie house downtown. It was intermission time when they got there, so Don had some time to think about what could possibly be dirtier than what he had already seen on Earth. He became sexually excited even before the house lights went down. The women in his party were all twittery and squirmy. So the theater went dark and the curtains opened. At first there wasn't any picture. There were slurps and moans from loudspeakers. Then the picture itself appeared. It was a high-quality film of a male humanoid eating what looked like a pear. The camera zoomed in on his lips and tongue and teeth, which glistened with saliva. He took his time about eating the pear. When the last of it had disappeared into his slurpy mouth, the camera focused on his Adam's apple. His Adam's apple bobbed obscenely. He belched contentedly. And then these words appeared on the screen, but in the language of the planet. The end. It was all faked, of course. There weren't any pears anymore. And the eating of a pear wasn't the main event of the evening anyway. It was a short subject, which gave the members of the audience time to settle down. Then the main feature began. It was about a male and a female and their two children and their dog and their cat. They ate steadily for an hour and a half. Soup, meat, biscuits, butter, vegetables, mashed potatoes and gravy, fruit, candy, cake, pie. The camera rarely strayed more than a foot from their glistening lips and their bobbing Adam's apples. And then the father put the cat and the dog on the table so they could take part in the orgy too. After a while, the actors couldn't eat any more. They were so stuffed that they were goggle-eyed. They could hardly move. They said they didn't think they could eat again for a week, and so on. They cleared the table slowly. They went waddling out to the kitchen, and they dumped about 30 pounds of leftovers into a garbage can. The audience went wild. When Don and his friends left the theater, they were accosted by humanoid whores who offered them eggs and oranges and milk and butter and peanuts and so on. The whores couldn't actually deliver these goodies, of course. The humanoids told Don that if he went home with a whore, she would cook him a meal of petroleum and coal products at fancy prices. And then, while he ate them, she would talk dirty about how fresh and full of natural juices the food was, even though the food was fake. 6. Duane Hoover sat in the used Plymouth Fury in his own vacant lot for an hour, listening to West Virginia. He was told about health insurance for pennies a day, about how to get better performance from his car. He was told what to do about constipation. He was offered a Bible, which had everything that God or Jesus had actually said out loud, printed in red capital letters. He was offered a plant which would attract and eat disease-carrying insects in his home. All this was stored away in Duane's memory, in case he should need it later on. He had all kinds of stuff in there. While Duane sat there so alone, the oldest inhabitant of Midland City was dying in the county hospital at the foot of Fairchild Boulevard, which was 9 miles away. She was Mary Young. She was 108 years old. She was black. Mary Young's parents had been human slaves in Kentucky. There was a tiny connection between Mary Young and Duane Hoover. She did the laundry for Duane's family for a few months back when Duane was a little boy. She told Bible stories and stories about slavery to little Duane. She told him about a public hanging of a white man she had seen in Cincinnati when she was a little girl. A black intern at the county hospital now watched Mary Young die of pneumonia. The intern did not know her. She had been in Midland City for only a week. He wasn't even a fellow American, although he had taken his medical degree at Harvard. He was an Indaro. He was a Nigerian. His name was Cyprian Ukwende. He felt no kinship with Mary or with any American blacks. He felt kinship only with Indaros. As she died, Mary was as alone on the planet as were Duane Hoover or Kilgore Trout. She had never reproduced. There were no friends or relatives to watch her die. So she spoke her very last words on the planet to Cyprian Ukwende. She did not have enough breath left to make her vocal cords buzz. She could only move her lips noiselessly. Here is all she had to say about death.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Like all earthlings at the point of death, Mary Young sent faint reminders of herself to those who had known her. She released a small cloud of telepathic butterflies, and one of these brushed the cheek of Duane Hoover 9 miles away. Duane heard a tired voice from somewhere behind his head, even though no one was back there. It said this to Duane.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Duane's bad chemicals now made him put his car in gear. He drove out of the vacant lot, proceeded sedately down Union Avenue, which paralleled the interstate. He went past his principal place of business, which was Duane Hoover's Exit 11 Pontiac Village, and he turned into the parking lot of the new Holiday Inn next door. Duane owned a third of the inn, in partnership with Midland City's leading orthodontist, Dr. Alfred Maritimo, and Bill Miller, who was chairman of the parole board at the Adult Correctional Institution at Shepherdstown, among other things. Duane went up the inn's back steps to the roof without meeting anybody. There was a full moon. There were two full moons. The new Mildred Berry Memorial Center for the Arts was a translucent sphere on stilts, and it was illuminated from the inside now, and it looked like a moon. Duane gazed over the sleeping city. He had been born there. He had spent the first 3 years of his life in an orphanage only 2 miles from where he stood. He had been adopted and educated there. He owned not only the Pontiac Agency and a piece of the new Holiday Inn, he owned 3 burger chefs, too, and 5 coin-operated car washes, and pieces of the Sugar Creek Drive-In Theater, radio station WMCY, the Three Maples Par 3 Golf Course, and 1,700 shares of common stock in Barrytron Limited, a local electronics firm. He owned dozens of vacant lots. He was on the board of directors of the Midland County National Bank. But now Midland City looked unfamiliar and frightening to Duane. "Where am I?" he said. He even forgot that his wife Celia had committed suicide, for instance, by eating Drano, a mixture of sodium hydroxide and aluminum flakes, which was meant to clear drains. Celia became a small volcano since she was composed of the same sorts of substances which commonly clog drains. Duane even forgot that his only child, a son, had grown up to be a notorious homosexual. His name was George, but everybody called him Bunny. He played piano in the cocktail lounge of the new Holiday Inn. "Where am I?" said Duane. 7. Kilgore Trout took a leak in the men's room of the New York City movie house. There was a sign on the wall next to the roller towel. It advertised a massage parlor called the Sultan's Harem. Massage parlors were something new and exciting in New York. Men could go in there and photograph naked women, or they could paint the woman's naked bodies with water-soluble paints. Men could be rubbed all over by a woman until their penises squirted jism into Turkish towels. "It's a full life and a merry one," said Kilgore Trout. There was a message written in pencil on the tiles by the roller towel. This was it. "What is the purpose of life?" Trout plundered his pockets for a pen or pencil. He had an answer to the question. But he had nothing to write with, not even a burnt match. So he left the question unanswered. But here is what he would have written, if he had found anything to write with. To be the eyes and ears and conscience of the creator of the universe, you fool. When Trout headed back for his seat in the theater, he played at being the eyes and ears and conscience of the creator of the universe. He sent messages by telepathy to the creator, whoever he was. He reported that the men's room had been clean as a whistle. The carpeting under my feet, he signaled from the lobby, is springy and new. I think it must be some miracle fiber. It's blue. You know what I mean by blue? And so on. When he got to the auditorium itself, the house lights were on. Nobody was there but the manager, who was also the ticket taker and the bouncer and the janitor. He was sweeping filth from between the seats. He was a middle-aged white man. No more fun tonight, grandfather, he said to Trout. Time to go home. Trout didn't protest. Neither did he leave immediately. He examined a green enameled steel box in the back of the auditorium. It contained the projector and the sound system and the films. There was a wire that led from the box to a plug in the wall. There was a hole in the front of the box. That was how the pictures got out. On the side of the box was a simple switch. It said, on, off. It intrigued Trout to know that he had only to flick the switch and the people would start fucking and sucking again. Good night, grandfather, said the manager pointedly. Trout took his leave of the machine reluctantly. He said this about it to the manager. It fills such a need, this machine, and it's so easy to operate. As Trout departed, he sent this telepathic message to the creator of the universe, serving as his eyes and ears and conscience. Am headed for 42nd Street now. How much do you already know about 42nd Street? 8. Trout wandered out onto the sidewalk of 42nd Street. It was a dangerous place to be. The whole city was dangerous, because of chemicals and the uneven distribution of wealth and so on. A lot of people were like Duane. They created chemicals in their own bodies which were bad for their heads. But there were thousands upon thousands of other people in the city who bought bad chemicals and ate them or sniffed them or injected them into their veins. Sometimes they even stuffed bad chemicals up their assholes. People took such awful chances with chemicals in their bodies because they wanted the quality of their lives to improve. They lived in ugly places where there were only ugly things to do. They didn't own Doodly Squat, so they couldn't improve their surroundings. So they did their best to make their insides beautiful instead. The results had been catastrophic so far, suicide, theft, murder, and insanity, and so on. But new chemicals were coming onto the market all the time. 20 feet away from Trout, there on 42nd Street, a 14-year-old white boy lay unconscious in the doorway of a pornography store. He had swallowed a half a pint of a new type of paint remover, which had gone on sale for the first time only the day before. He had also swallowed two pills, which were intended to prevent contagious abortion in cattle, which was called Bang's disease. Trout was petrified there on 42nd Street. It had given him a life not worth living, but it had also given him an iron will to live. This was a common combination on the planet Earth. The theater manager came out and locked the door behind him. And two young black prostitutes materialized from nowhere. They asked Trout and the manager if they would like to have some fun. They were cheerful and unafraid because of a tube of Norwegian hemorrhoid remedy, which they had eaten about a half hour before. The manufacturer had never intended the stuff to be eaten. People were supposed to squirt it up their assholes. These were country girls. They had grown up in the rural south of the nation where their ancestors had been used as agricultural machinery. The white farmers down there weren't using machines made out of meat anymore, though, because machines made out of metal were cheaper and more reliable and required simpler homes. So the black machines had to get out of there or starve to death. They came to cities because every place else had signs on the fences and trees. They said, "No trespassing. This means you." Kilgore Trout once wrote a story called This Means You. It was set in the Hawaiian Islands, the place where the lucky winners of Duane Hoover's contest in Midland City were supposed to go. Every bit of land on the islands was owned by only about 40 people, and, in the story, Trout had those people decide to exercise their property rights to the full. They put up no trespassing signs on everything. This created terrible problems for the million other people on the islands. The law of gravity required that they stick somewhere on the surface. Either that, or they could go out into the water and bob offshore. But then the federal government came through with an emergency program. It gave a big balloon full of helium to every man, woman, and child who didn't own property. There was a cable with a harness on it dangling from each balloon. With the help of the balloons, Hawaiians could go on inhabiting the islands without always sticking to things other people owned. The prostitutes worked for a pimp now. He was splendid and cruel. He was a god to them. He took their free will away from them, which was perfectly all right. They didn't want it anyway. It was as though they had surrendered themselves to Jesus, for instance, so they could live unselfishly and trustingly, except that they had surrendered to a pimp instead. Their childhoods were over. They were dying now. Earth was a tin-horn planet, as far as they were concerned. When Trout and the theater manager, two tin-horns, said they didn't want any tin-horn fun, the dying children sauntered off, their feet sticking to the planet, coming unstuck, then sticking again. They disappeared around a corner. Trout, the eyes and the ears of the creator of the universe, sneezed. "God bless you," said the manager. This was a fully automatic response many Americans had to hearing a person sneeze. "Thank you," said Trout. Thus, a temporary friendship was formed. Trout said he hoped to get safely to a cheap hotel. The manager said he hoped to get to the subway station on Times Square. So they walked together, encouraged by the echoes of their footsteps from the building facades. The manager told Trout a little about what the planet looked like to him. It was a place where he had a wife and two kids, he said. They didn't know he ran a theater which showed blue movies. They thought he was doing consulting work as an engineer so late at night. He said that the planet didn't have much use for engineers his age anymore. It had adored them once. "Hard times," said Trout. The manager told of being in on the development of a miraculous insulating material which had been used on rocket ships to the moon. This was, in fact, the same material which gave the aluminum siding of Dwayne Hoover's dream house in Midland City its miraculous insulating qualities. The manager reminded Trout of what the first man to set foot on the moon had said. "One small step for man, one great leap for mankind." "Thrilling words," said Trout. He looked over his shoulder, perceived that they were being followed by a white Oldsmobile Toronado with a black vinyl roof. This 400-horsepower front-wheel drive vehicle was burbling along at about 300 miles an hour, 10 feet behind them and close to the curb. That was the last thing Trout remembered, seeing the Oldsmobile back there. The next thing he knew, he was on his hands and knees on a handball court underneath the Queensboro Bridge at 59th Street, with the East River nearby. His trousers and underpants were around his ankles, his money was gone. His parcels were scattered around him, the tuxedo, the new shirt, the books. Blood seeped from one ear. The police caught him in the act of pulling up his trousers. They dazzled him with a spotlight as he leaned against the backboard of the handball court and fumbled foolishly with his belt and the buttons on his fly. The police supposed that they had caught him committing some public nuisance, had caught him working with an old man's limited palate of excrement and alcohol. He wasn't quite penniless. There was a $10 bill in the watch pocket of his pants. It was determined at a hospital that Trout was not seriously hurt. He was taken to a police station where he was questioned. All he could say was that he had been kidnapped by pure evil in a white Oldsmobile. The police wanted to know how many people were in the car, their ages, their sexes, the color of their skins, their manners of speech. "For all I know, they may not even have been Earthlings," said Trout. "For all I know, that car may have been occupied by an intelligent gas from Pluto." Trout said this so innocently, but his comment turned out to be the first germ in an epidemic of mind poisoning. Here's how the disease was spread. A reporter wrote a story for the New York Post the next day, and he led off with a quotation from Trout. The story appeared under this headline: "Pluto Bandits, Kidnap Pair." Trout's name was given as Kilmer Trotter, incidentally, address unknown. His age was given as 82. Other papers copied the story, rewrote it some. They all hung on to the joke about Pluto, spoke knowingly of the Pluto gang. And reporters asked police for any new information on the Pluto gang, so police went looking for information on the Pluto gang. So New Yorkers, who had so many nameless terrors, were easily taught to fear something seemingly specific, the Pluto gang. They bought new locks for their doors and gratings for their windows to keep out the Pluto gang. They stopped going to theaters at night for fear of the Pluto gang. Foreign newspapers spread the terror, ran articles on how persons thinking of visiting New York might keep to a certain few streets in Manhattan and stand a fair chance of avoiding the Pluto Gang. In one of New York City's many ghettos for dark-skinned people, a group of Puerto Rican boys gathered together in the basement of an abandoned building. They were small, but they were numerous and volatile. They wished to become frightening in order to defend themselves and their friends and families, something the police wouldn't do. They also wanted to drive the drug peddlers out of the neighborhood and to get enough publicity, which was very important, to catch the attention of the government so that the government would do a better job of picking up the garbage and so on. One of them, Jose Mendoza, was a fairly good painter, so he painted the emblem of their new gang on the backs of the members' jackets. It said, Pluto Gang. 9. While Kilgore Trout was inadvertently poisoning the collective mind of New York City, Dwayne Hoover, the demented Pontiac dealer, was coming down from the roof of his own Holiday Inn in the Middle West. Dwayne went into the carpeted lobby of the place not long before sunrise to ask for a room. As queer as the hour was, there was a man ahead of him, and a black one at that. This was Cyprian Ukwende, the Indaro, the physician from Nigeria, who was staying at the inn until he could find a suitable apartment. Dwayne awaited his turn humbly. He had forgotten that he was a co-owner of the inn. As for staying at a place where black men stayed, Dwayne was philosophical. He experienced a sort of bittersweet happiness as he told himself, "Times change, times change." The night clerk was new. He did not know Dwayne. He had Dwayne fill out a registration in full. Dwayne, for his part, apologized for not knowing what the number of his license plate was. He felt guilty about that, even though he knew he had done nothing he should feel guilty about. He was elated when the clerk let him have a room key. He had passed the test, and he adored his room. It was so new and cool and clean. It was so neutral. It was the brother of thousands upon thousands of rooms in Holiday Inns all over the world. Dwayne Hoover might be confused as to what his life was all about or what he should do with it next. But this much he has done correctly. He had delivered himself to an irreproachable container for a human being. It awaited anybody. It awaited Dwayne. Around the toilet seat was a band of paper, which he would have to remove before he used the toilet. It said, sanitary. This loop of paper guaranteed Dwayne that he could have no fear that corkscrew-shaped little animals would crawl up his asshole and eat up his wiring. That was one less worry for Dwayne. There was a sign hanging on the inside doorknob, which Dwayne now hung on the outside doorknob. It said, please do not disturb. Dwayne pulled open his floor-to-ceiling draperies for a moment. He saw the sign which announced the presence of the inn to weary travelers on the interstate. Here is what it said. Holiday Inn, the world's innkeeper. He closed his draperies. He adjusted the heating and ventilating system. He slept like a lamb. A lamb was a young animal which was legendary for sleeping well on the planet Earth. 10. Kilgore Trout was released by the police department of the city of New York like a weightless thing at 2 hours before dawn on the day after Veterans Day. He crossed the island of Manhattan from east to west in the company of Kleenex tissues and newspapers and soot. He got a ride in a truck. It was hauling 78,000 pounds of Spanish olives. It picked him up at the mouth of the Lincoln Tunnel, which was named in honor of a man who had had the courage and imagination to make human slavery against the law in the United States of America. This was a recent innovation. The slaves were simply turned loose without any property. They were easily recognizable. They were black. They were suddenly free to go exploring. The driver, who was white, told Trout that he would have to lie on the floor of the cab until they reached open country, since it was against the law for him to pick up hitchhikers. It was still dark when he told Trout he could sit up. They were crossing the poisoned marshes and meadows of New Jersey. The truck was a General Motors Astro 95 diesel tractor, hooked up to a tractor 40 feet long. It was so enormous that it made Trout feel that his head was about the size of a piece of BB shot. The driver said he used to be a hunter and a fisherman long ago. It broke his heart when he imagined what the marshes and meadows had been like only 100 years before. And when you think of the shit that most of these factories make, wash day products, cat food, pop. He had a point. The planet was being destroyed by manufacturing processes, and what was being manufactured was lousy, by and large. Then Trout made a good point, too. Well, he said, I used to be a conservationist. I used to weep and wail about people shooting bald eagles with automatic shotguns from helicopters and all that, but I gave it up. There's a river in Cleveland which is so polluted that it catches fire about once a year. That used to make me sick, but I laugh about it now. When some tanker accidentally dumps its load in the ocean and kills millions of birds and billions of fish, I say, more power to Standard Oil or whoever it was that dumped it. Trout raised his arms in celebration. Up your ass with mobile gas, he said. The driver was upset by this. You're kidding, he said. I realized, said Trout, that God wasn't any conservationist. So for anybody else to be, one was sacrilegious and a waste of time. You ever see one of his volcanoes or tornadoes or tidal waves? Anybody ever tell you about the ice age he arranges for every 500,000 years? How about Dutch elm disease? There's a nice conservation measure for you. That's God, not man. Just about the time we got our rivers cleaned up, he'd probably have the whole galaxy go up like a celluloid collar. That's what the Star of Bethlehem was, you know. What was the Star of Bethlehem? Said the driver. A whole galaxy going up like a celluloid collar, said Trout. The driver was impressed. Come to think about it, he said, I don't think there's anything about conservation anywhere in the Bible. Unless you want to count the story about the flood, said Trout. They rode in silence for a while, and the driver made another good point. He said he knew that his truck was turning the atmosphere into poison gas, and that the planet was being turned into pavement so his truck could go anywhere. So I'm committing suicide, he said. Don't worry about it, said Trout. My brother is even worse, the driver went on. He works in a factory that makes chemicals for killing plants and trees in Vietnam. Vietnam was a country where America was trying to make people stop being communists by dropping things on them from airplanes. The chemicals he mentioned were intended to kill all the foliage, so it would be harder for communists to hide from the airplanes. Don't worry about it, said Trout. In the long run, he's committing suicide, said the driver. Seems like the only kind of job an American can get these days is committing suicide in some way. Good point, said Trout. I can't tell if you're serious or not, said the driver. I won't know myself until I find out whether life is serious or not, said Trout. It's dangerous, I know, and it can hurt a lot. That doesn't necessarily mean it's serious, too. After Trout became famous, of course, one of the biggest mysteries about him was whether he was kidding or not. He told one persistent questioner that he always crossed his fingers when he was kidding. And please note, he went on, that when I gave you that priceless piece of information, my fingers were crossed. And so on. He was a pain in the neck in a lot of ways. The truck driver got sick of him after an hour or two. Trout used the silence to make up an anti-conservation story he called Gilgongo. Gilgongo was about a planet which was unpleasant because there was too much creation going on. The story began with a big party in honor of a man who had wiped out an entire species of darling little panda bears. He had devoted his life to this. Special plates were made for the party, and the guests got to take them home as souvenirs. There was a picture of a little bear on each one and the date of the party. Underneath the picture was the word Gilgongo. In the language of the planet, that meant extinct. People were glad that the bears were Gilgongo because there were too many species on the planet already, and new ones were coming into being almost every hour. There was no way anybody could prepare for the bewildering diversity of creatures and plants he was likely to encounter. The people were doing their best to cut down on the number of species so that life could be more predictable. But nature was too creative for them. All life on the planet was suffocated at last by a living blanket 100 feet thick. The blanket was composed of passenger pigeons and eagles and Bermuda urns and whooping cranes. At least it's olives, said the driver. What? Said Trout. Lots worse things we could be hauling than olives. Right, said Trout. He had forgotten that the main thing they were doing was moving 78,000 pounds of olives to Tulsa, Oklahoma. The driver talked about politics some. Trout couldn't tell one politician from another. They were all formlessly enthusiastic chimpanzees to him. He wrote a story one time about an optimistic chimpanzee who became president of the United States. He called it Hail to the Chief. The chimpanzee wore a little blue blazer with brass buttons and the seal of the President of the United States sewed to the breast pocket. Everywhere he went, bands would play Hail to the Chief. The chimpanzee loved it. He would bounce up and down. They stopped at a diner. Here is what the sign in front of the diner said. Eat. So they ate. Trot spotted an idiot who was eating, too. The idiot was a white male adult in the care of a white female nurse. The idiot couldn't talk much, and he had a lot of trouble feeding himself. The nurse put a bib around his neck. But he certainly had a wonderful appetite. Trout watched him shuffle waffles and pork sausage into his mouth, watched him guzzle orange juice and milk. Trout marveled at what a big animal the idiot was. The idiot's happiness was fascinating, too, as he stoked himself with calories, which would get him through yet another day. Trout said this to himself, "Stoking up for another day." "Excuse me," said the truck driver to Trout. "I gotta take a leak." "Back where I come from," said Trout, "that means you're going to steal a mirror. We call mirrors leaks." "I've never heard that before," said the driver. He repeated the word, "leaks." He pointed to a mirror on a cigarette machine. "You call that a leak?" "Doesn't that look like a leak to you?" said Trout. "No," said the driver. "Where did you say you were from?" "I was born in Bermuda." About a week later, the driver would tell his wife that mirrors were called leaks in Bermuda, and she would tell her friends. When Trout followed the driver back to the truck, he took his first good look at their form of transportation from a distance, saw it whole. There was a message written on the side of it in bright orange letters, which were 8 feet high. It said, "Pyramid." Trout wondered what a child who was just learning to read would make of a message like that. The child would suppose that the message was terrifically important, since somebody had gone to the trouble of writing it in letters so big. And then, pretending to be a child by the roadside, he read the message on the side of another truck. It said, "Ajax." 11. Dwayne Hoover slept until 10 at the new Holiday Inn. He was much refreshed. He had a number 5 breakfast in the popular restaurant of the inn, which was the Tally Ho Room. The drapes were drawn at night. They were wide open now. They let the sunshine in. At the next table, also alone, was Cyprian Ukwende, the Indaro, the Nigerian. He was reading the classified ads in the Midland City Bugle Observer. He needed a cheap place to live. The Midland County General Hospital was footing his bills at the inn while he looked around, and they were getting restless about that. He needed a woman, too, or a bunch of women who would fuck him hundreds of times a week, because he was so full of lust and jism all the time. And he ached to be with his Indaro relatives. Back home, he had 600 relatives he knew by name. Ukwende's face was impassive as he ordered the number 3 breakfast with whole wheat toast. Behind his mask was a young man in the terminal stages of nostalgia and lover's nuts. Dwayne Hoover, 6 feet away, gazed out at the busy, sunny interstate highway. He knew where he was. There was a familiar moat between the parking lot of the inn and the interstate, the concrete trough which the engineers had built to contain Sugar Creek. Next came a familiar, resilient steel barrier which prevented cars and trucks from tumbling into Sugar Creek. Next came the 3 familiar westbound lanes, and then the familiar grassy median divider. After that came the 3 familiar eastbound lanes, and then another familiar steel barrier. After that, the familiar Will Fairchild Memorial Airport, and then the familiar farmlands beyond. It was certainly flat out there. Flat city, flat township, flat country, flat state. When Dwayne was a little boy, he had supposed that almost everybody lived in places that were treeless and flat. He imagined that oceans and mountains and forests were mainly sequestered in state and national parks. In the 3rd grade, little Dwayne scrawled an essay which argued in favor of creating a national park at a bend in Sugar Creek, the only significant water surface within 8 miles of Midland City. Dwayne said the name of that familiar surface water to himself now, silently. Sugar Creek. Sugar Creek was only 2 inches deep and 50 yards wide at the bend where little Dwayne thought the park should be. Now they had put the Mildred Barry Memorial Center for the Arts there instead. It was beautiful. Dwayne fiddled with his lapel for a moment, felt a badge pinned there. He unpinned it, having no recollection of what it said. It was a boost for the arts festival, which would begin that evening. All over town, people were wearing badges like Dwayne's. Here's what the badges said. Support the arts. Sugar Creek flooded now and then. Dwayne remembered about that. In a land so flat, flooding was a queerly pretty thing for water to do. Sugar Creek brimmed over silently, formed a vast mirror in which children might safely play. The mirror showed the citizens the shape of the valley they lived in, demonstrated that they were hill people who inhabited slopes rising 1 inch for every mile that separated them from Sugar Creek. Duane silently said the name of the water again, Sugar Creek. Duane finished his breakfast, and he dared to suppose that he was no longer mentally diseased, that he had been cured by a simple change of residence, by a good night's sleep. His bad chemicals let him cross the lobby and then the cocktail lounge, which wasn't open yet, without experiencing anything strange. But when he stepped out of the side door of the cocktail lounge and onto the asphalt prairie which surrounded both his inn and his Pontiac agency, he discovered that someone had turned the asphalt into a sort of trampoline. It sank beneath Duane's weight. It dropped Duane to well below street level, then slowly brought him only partway up again. He was in a shallow, rubbery dimple. Duane took another step in the direction of his automobile agency. He sank down again, came up again, and stood in a brand new dimple. He gawked around for witnesses. There was only one. Cyprian Ukwende stood on the rim of the dimple, not sinking in. This was all Ukwende had to say, even though Duane's situation was extraordinary. Nice day. Duane progressed from dimple to dimple. He blooped across the used car lot now. He stopped in a dimple, looked up at another young black man. This one was polishing a maroon 1970 Buick Skylark convertible with a rag. The man wasn't dressed for that sort of work. He wore a cheap blue suit and a white shirt and a black necktie. Also, he wasn't merely polishing the car, he was burnishing it. The young man did some more burnishing, then he smiled at Duane blindingly, then he burnished the car again. Here was the explanation. This young black man had just been paroled from the adult correctional institution at Shepherdstown. He needed work right away, or he would starve to death. So he was showing Duane how hard a worker he was. He had been in orphanages and youth shelters and prisons of one sort or another in the Midland City area since he was 9 years old. He was now 26. He was free at last. Duane thought the young man was an hallucination. The young man went back to burnishing the automobile. His life was not worth living. He had a feeble will to survive. He thought the planet was terrible, that he never should have been sent there. Some mistake had been made. He had no friends or relatives. He was put in cages all the time. He had a name for a better world, and he often saw it in dreams. Its name was a secret. He would have been ridiculed if he had said its name out loud. It was such a childish name. The young black jailbird could see the name any time he wanted to, written in lights on the inside of his skull. This is what it said. Fairyland. He had a photograph of Duane in his wallet. He used to have photographs of Duane on the walls of his cell at Shepherdstown. They were easy to get because Duane's smiling face, with his motto underneath, was a part of every ad he ran in the Bugle Observer. The picture was changed every 6 months. The motto hadn't varied in 25 years. Here was the motto. Ask anybody. You can trust Duane. The young ex-convict smiled yet again at Duane. His teeth were in perfect repair. The dental program at Shepherdstown was excellent. So was the food. Good morning, sir, said the young man to Duane. He was dismayingly innocent. There was so much he had to learn. He didn't know about women, for instance. Francine Pefko was the first woman he had spoken to in 11 years. Good morning, said Duane. He said it softly so his voice wouldn't carry very far, in case he was conversing with an hallucination. Sir, I have read your ads in the papers with great interest, and I have found pleasure in your radio advertising, too, the parolee said. During the last year in prison, he had been obsessed by one idea, that he would work for Duane someday and live happily ever after. It would be like fairyland. Duane made no reply to this, so the young man went on. I'm a very hard worker, sir, as you can see. I hear nothing but good things about you. I think the good Lord meant for me to work for you. Oh, said Duane. Our names are so close, said the young man. It's the good Lord telling us both what to do. Duane Hoover didn't ask him what his name was, but the young man told him anyway, radiantly. My name, sir, is Wayne Hubler. All around Midland City, Hubler was a common nigger name. Duane Hoover broke Wayne Hubler's heart by shaking his head vaguely, then walking away. Duane entered his showroom. The ground wasn't blooping underneath him anymore, but now he saw something else for which there could be no explanation. A palm tree was growing out of the showroom floor. Dwayne's bad chemicals had made him forget all about Hawaiian Week. Actually, Dwayne had designed the palm tree himself. It was a sawed-off telephone pole swaddled in burlap. It had real coconuts nailed to the top of it. Sheets of green plastic had been cut to resemble leaves. The tree so bewildered Dwayne that he almost swooned. Then he looked around and saw pineapples and ukuleles scattered everywhere. And then he saw the most unbelievable thing of all. His sales manager, Harry LeSabre, came toward him leeringly, wearing a lettuce-green leotard, straw sandals, a grass skirt, and a pink T-shirt, which said, "Make love, not war." Harry and his wife had spent all weekend arguing about whether or not Dwayne suspected that Harry was a transvestite. They concluded that Dwayne had no reason to suspect it. Harry never talked about women's clothes to Dwayne. He had never entered a transvestite beauty contest or done what a lot of transvestites in Midland City did, which was join a big transvestite club over in Cincinnati. He never went into the city's transvestite bar, which was Ye Old Rathskeller, in the basement of the Fairchild Hotel. He never exchanged Polaroid pictures with any other transvestites, had never subscribed to a transvestite magazine. Harry and his wife concluded that Dwayne had meant nothing more than what he said, that Harry had better put on some wild clothes for Hawaiian Week, or Dwayne would can him. So here was the new Harry now, rosy with fear and excitement. He felt uninhibited and beautiful and lovable and suddenly free. He greeted Dwayne with a Hawaiian word, which meant both hello and goodbye. "Aloha," he said. 12. Kilgore Trout was far away, but he was steadily closing the distance between himself and Dwayne. He was still in the truck named Pyramid. It was crossing a bridge named in honor of the poet Walt Whitman. The bridge was veiled in smoke. The truck was about to become part of Philadelphia now. A sign at the foot of the bridge said this: "You are now entering the city of brotherly love." As a younger man, Trout would have sneered at the sign about brotherhood, posted on the rim of a bomb crater, as anyone could see. But his head no longer sheltered ideas of how things could be and should be on the planet, as opposed to how they really were. There was only one way for the Earth to be, he thought, the way it was. Everything was necessary. He saw an old white woman fishing through a garbage can. That was necessary. He saw a bathtub toy, a little rubber duck, lying on its side on the grating over a storm sewer. It had to be there. And so on. The driver mentioned that the day before had been Veterans Day. Said Trout. "You a veteran?" said the driver. "No," said Trout. "Are you?" "No," said the driver. Neither of them was a veteran. The driver got onto the subject of friends. He said it was hard for him to maintain friendships that meant anything because he was on the road most of the time. He joked about the time when he used to talk about his best friends. He guessed people stopped talking about best friends after they got out of junior high school. He suggested that Trout, since Trout was in the combination aluminum storm window and screen business, had opportunities to build many lasting friendships in the course of his work. "I mean," he said, "you get men working together day after day, putting up those windows, they get to know each other pretty well." "I work alone," said Trout. The driver was disappointed. "I assumed it would take two men to do the job." "Just one," said Trout. "A weak little kid could do it without any help." The driver wanted Trout to have a rich social life so that he could enjoy it vicariously. "All the same," he insisted, "you got buddies you see after work. You have a few beers, you play some cards, you have some laughs." Trout shrugged. "You walk down the same streets every day," the driver told him. "You know a lot of people and they know you because it's the same streets for you day after day. You say hello and they say hello back. You call them by name, they call you by name. If you're in a real jam, they'll help you because you're one of them. You belong. They see you every day." Trout didn't want to argue about it. Trout had forgotten the driver's name. Trout had a mental defect, which I, too, used to suffer from. He couldn't remember what different people in his life looked like unless their bodies or faces were strikingly unusual. When he lived on Cape Cod, for instance, the only person he could greet warmly and by name was Alfie Beers, who was a one-armed albino. "Hot enough for you, Alfie?" he would say. "Where have you been keeping yourself, Alfie?" he'd say. "You're a sight for sore eyes, Alfie," he'd say, and so on. Now that Trout lived in Coho's, the only person he called by name was a red-haired cockney midget, Derling Heath. He worked in a shoe repair shop. Heath had an executive-type nameplate on his workbench, in case anybody wished to address him by name. The nameplate said, "Derling Heath." Trout would drop into the shop from time to time and say such things as, Who's going to win the World Series this year, Durling? And you have any idea what all the sirens were blowing about last night, Durling? And you're looking good today, Durling. Where'd you get that shirt? And so on. Trout wondered now if his friendship with Heath was over. The last time Trout had been in the shoe repair place, saying this and that to Durling, the midget had unexpectedly screamed at him. This is what he had screamed in his Cockney accent. Stop bloody ounding me. The governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller, shook Trout's hand in a Coho's grocery store one time. Trout had no idea who he was. As a science fiction writer, he should have been flabbergasted to come so close to such a man. Rockefeller wasn't merely governor. Because of the peculiar laws in that part of the planet, Rockefeller was allowed to own vast areas of the Earth's surface and the petroleum and other valuable minerals underneath the surface as well. He owned or controlled more of the planet than many nations. This had been his destiny since infancy. He had been born into that cockamamie proprietorship. How's it going, fella? Governor Rockefeller asked him. About the same, said Kilgore Trout. After insisting that Trout had a rich social life, the driver pretended, again for his own gratification, that Trout had begged to know what the sex life of a transcontinental truck driver was like. Trout had begged no such thing. You want to know how truck drivers make out with women, right? The driver said. You have this idea that every driver you see is fucking up a storm from coast to coast, right? Trout shrugged. The truck driver became embittered by Trout, scolded him for being so salaciously misinformed. Let me tell you, Kilgore, he hesitated. That's your name, right? Yes, said Trout. He had forgotten the driver's name 100 times. Every time Trout looked away from him, Trout forgot not only his name, but his face, too. Kilgore, goddammit, the driver said. If I was to have my rig break down in Coho's, for instance, and I was to have to stay there for 2 days while it was worked on, how easy do you think it would be for me to get laid while I was there? A stranger, looking the way I do. It would depend on how determined you were, said Trout. The driver sighed. Yeah, God, he said, and he despaired for himself. That's probably the story of my life. Not enough determination. They talked about aluminum siding as a technique for making old houses look new again. From a distance, these sheets, which never needed painting, looked like freshly painted wood. The driver wanted to talk about permastone, too, which was a competitive scheme. It involved plastering the sides of old houses with colored cement so that, from a distance, they looked as though they were made of stone. If you're in aluminum storm windows, the driver said to Trout, you must be in aluminum siding, too. All over the country, the two businesses went hand in hand. My company sells it, said Trout, and I've seen a lot of it. I've never actually worked on an installation. The driver was thinking seriously of buying aluminum siding for his home in Little Rock, and he begged Trout to give him an honest answer to this question. From what you've seen and heard, the people who get aluminum siding, are they happy with what they get? Around Coho's, said Trout, I think those were about the only really happy people I ever saw. I know what you mean, said the driver. One time I saw a whole family standing outside their house. They couldn't believe how nice their house looked after the aluminum siding went on. My question to you, and you give me an honest answer, on account of we'll never have to do business, you and me, Kilgore, how long will that happiness last? About 15 years, said Trout. Our salesmen say you can easily afford to have the job redone with all the money you've saved on paint and heat. Permastone looks a lot richer, and I suppose it lasts a lot longer, too, said the driver. On the other hand, it costs a lot more. You get what you pay for, said Kilgore Trout. The truck driver told Trout about a gas hot water heater he had bought 30 years ago, and it hadn't given him a speck of trouble in all that time. I'll be damned, said Kilgore Trout. Trout asked about the truck, and the driver said it was the greatest truck in the world. The tractor alone cost $28,000. It was powered by a 324-horsepower Cummins diesel engine, which was turbocharged so it would function well at high altitudes. It had hydraulic steering, air brakes, a 13-speed transmission, and was owned by his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law, he said, owned 28 trucks and was president of the Pyramid Trucking Company. Why did he name his company Pyramid? Asked Trout. I mean, this thing can go 100 miles an hour if it has to. It's fast and useful and unornamental. It's as up-to-date as a rocket ship. I never saw anything that was less like a pyramid than this truck. A pyramid was a sort of huge stone tomb which Egyptians had built thousands and thousands of years before. The Egyptians didn't build them anymore. Tourists would come from far away to gaze at them.
Why would anybody in the business of high-speed transportation name his business and his trucks after buildings which haven't moved an eighth of an inch since Christ was born?
The driver's answer was prompt. It was peevish, too, as though he thought Trout was stupid to have to ask a question like that.
He liked the sound of it, he said. Don't you like the sound of it?
Trout nodded in order to keep things friendly.
Yes, he said. It's a very nice sound.
Trout sat back and thought about the conversation. He shaped it into a story, which he never got around to writing until he was an old, old man. It was about a planet where the language kept turning into pure music because the creatures were so enchanted by sounds. Words became musical notes. Sentences became melodies. They were useless as conveyors of information because nobody knew or cared what the meaning of words were anymore. So leaders in government and commerce, in order to function, had to invent new and much uglier vocabularies and sentence structures all the time, which would resist being transmuted into music. "You married Kilgore?" the driver asked. 3 times, said Trout. It was true. Not only that, but each of his wives had been extraordinarily patient and loving and beautiful. Each had been shriveled by his pessimism.
"Any kids?"
"1, said Trout. Somewhere in the past, tumbling among all the wives and stories lost in the mails, was a son named Leo.
He's a man now, said Trout.
Leo left home forever at the age of 14. He lied about his age and he joined the Marines. He sent a note to his father from boot camp. It said this: "I pity you. You've crawled up your own asshole and died." This was the last Trout heard from Leo, directly or indirectly, until he was visited by 2 agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Leo had deserted from his division in Vietnam, they said. He had committed high treason. He had joined the Viet Cong. Here was the FBI evaluation of Leo's situation on the planet at that time. "Your boy's in bad trouble," they said. 13. When Dwayne Hoover saw Harry LeSabre, his sales manager, in leaf-green leotards and a grass skirt and all that, he could not believe it. So he made himself not see it. He went into his office, which was also cluttered with ukuleles and pineapples. Francine Pefko, his secretary, looked normal, except that she had a rope of flowers around her neck and a flower behind one ear. She smiled. This was a war widow with lips like sofa pillows and bright red hair. She adored Dwayne. She adored Hawaiian Week, too. "Aloha," she said. Harry LeSabre, meanwhile, had been destroyed by Dwayne. When Harry presented himself to Dwayne so ridiculously, every molecule in his body awaited Dwayne's reaction. Each molecule ceased its business for a moment, put some distance between itself and its neighbors. Each molecule waited to learn whether its galaxy, which was called Harry LeSabre, would or would not be dissolved. When Dwayne treated Harry as though he were invisible, Harry thought he had revealed himself as a revolting transvestite and that he was fired on that account. Harry closed his eyes. He never wanted to open them again. His heart sent this message to his molecules: "For reasons obvious to us all, this galaxy is dissolved." Dwayne didn't know anything about that. He leaned on Francine Pefko's desk. He came close to telling her how sick he was. He warned her, "This is a very tough day for some reason. So no jokes, no surprises. Keep everything simple. Keep anybody the least bit nutty out of here. No telephone calls." Francine told Dwayne that the twins were waiting for him in the inner office. "Something bad is happening to the cave, I think," she told him. Dwayne was grateful for a message that simple and clear. The twins were his younger stepbrothers, Lyle and Kyle Hoover. The cave was Sacred Miracle Cave, a tourist trap just south of Shepherdstown, which Dwayne owned in partnership with Lyle and Kyle. It was the sole source of income for Lyle and Kyle, who lived in identical yellow ranch houses on either side of the gift shop, which sheltered the entrance to the cave. All over the state, nailed to trees and fence posts, were arrow-shaped signs which pointed in the direction of the cave and said how far away it was. For example, "Visit Sacred Miracle Cave, 52 miles. Before Dwayne entered his inner office, he read one of many comical signs which Francine had put up on the wall in order to amuse people, to remind them of what they so easily forgot, that people don't have to be serious all the time. Here was the text of the sign Dwayne read: "You don't have to be crazy to work here, but it sure helps. There was a picture of a crazy person to go with the text. Francine wore a button on her bosom, which showed a creature in a healthier, more enviable frame of mind. Lyle and Kyle sat side by side on the black leather couch in Dwayne Hoover's inner office. They looked so much alike that Dwayne had not been able to tell them apart until 1954, when Lyle got in a fight over a woman at the roller derby. After that, Lyle was the one with a broken nose.